Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Sports, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Keith Rathbun, and I'm coming to you live from Macquarie University, actually for real this time, not at my house, but at my work. And I am here today speaking with the author of a killer new book, and one that I think is going to be of much interest to people interested in, especially kind of critical theory in sports. This is Shannon Walsh. She's an associate professor of theater history at Louisiana State University. And the book is Eugenics and Physical Culture Performance. Eugenics and Physical Culture Performance in the Progressive Era, Watch Whiteness Workout. It's out from Palgrave Macmillan in 2020. Thank you for joining me, Shannon.
Thank you, Keith.
Shannon, I wanted to, of course, kind of reiterate that I really love this book. I interview a lot of people for the podcast, talk to a lot of sports people in sports studies, mostly in sports history, but it's rare to find such critical engagement. So that was really refreshing. And I kind of had to brush up myself a bit, thinking back to my Bourdieu. But I wonder, Shannon, if you can tell us a bit how you developed this project. Like, what brought you to studying sport and physical culture? I should say physical culture rather. When you're a professor of theater history.
Sweet, thanks, Keith. Yeah. There's two sort of stories about that. You talk about it being, historical. I think I'm an accidental historian, and now I love being a historian, but so that story is that, I had really planned, this is a revision and expansion of my dissertation work, and I had planned for my dissertation in grad school at the University of Minnesota to actually be on fan cultures. I was all gung-ho on writing about American football fan cultures. And I had my sights, and I had already done, extensive research and an annotated bibliography, and I was super excited about it. And then I took a 19th century history class because I was in the program I was in was theater historiography, even though, again, I kept thinking, like, why am I in this program when I don't think I'm actually a historian or a historiographer? And I went into, I found an archive on campus. We had to find, I had to write a seminar paper, and I found out that, there was a YWCA archive on campus, and I was like, cool, I haven't done archival research before. I'm going to go check this out. And I found I found Abby Mayhew, who is the subject of my one of the chapters in my book, and I sort of like got a like hardcore historian crush on her. I was like, I think I might really want to write about this. She, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, You know, she was from Wisconsin and moved to Minnesota, and she reminded me of my grandmother, right? They were sort of in the same, you know, overlapped a little bit. And so then I got a little bit of archive fever and found, you know, went and researched Dudley Allen Sargent at Harvard, and then did some research at the H.J. Lucher Stark Archives at the University of Texas, Austin, and just sort of really caught that bug of historical research, and that's where this landed. But like, the interesting part is that I as I said, I really wanted to do sort of theoretical digging into my work to begin with. And the way that I found sports is weird and fabulous. I'm a huge sports fan, and my husband is a jock, and so we would watch sports together, and I played fantasy American football, and I got really frustrated when I was a master's student because I was watching American football, and they had just made the change to allow women sports broadcasters from the sideline. And when they first, you know, had women on the sidelines of, you know, NFL games, they did not look like they belonged there. They were in dresses and heels, and they put them in pastels. And I was like, you know, if NFL really wants to get, you know, more women watching their games, this is not the way to do it. And so I wrote my master's thesis on how the male gaze, G-A-Z-E, operates in sports, because I found myself as a woman sports fan trying to enjoy sports, but having to read against the grain that was being offered. And so that's really where that sort of spectatorship in theater and sports kind of overlapped for me to begin with. And it's just I've just expanded my love for both of those things and how performance theory can really help deepen the way that we think about sports since then.
Yeah, I mean, the introduction of your book in particular is really kind of rich for people who are interested in sports studies, because it's, like I say, it's rare that you get people who are interested in critical theory writing in clear ways about how, you know, maybe people beyond Foucault are interesting for us. But also the other thing I think, you know, a fair number of people kind of, like in myself, like I'm complaining about myself, I think. But a fair number of people are interested in kind of biopolitics or governmentality, but don't use them in quite as precise ways as you do. But the other thing I really liked about your introduction and in many of the introductions to your chapters is that you kind of mentioned it in when you're just talking, but that kind of self-reflexiveness that you have, where you kind of frame out, you're like, I'm writing a kind of a history of the progressive era, but then you start the beginning of the book and the end of the book in the now. And so you get a real sense that what you're saying about the progressive era actually matters now. and you know, that there's this kind of reflexiveness about the archives. Like when you're talking about Abby Mayhew, you're like, you do mention, you're like, I fell in love. I don't think you called it a crush, but you did say like you fell in love with her as a subject. And then you realize, like, maybe later, maybe there's a lot of problems with this, and critical theory helps you get there.
So yeah.
Well, my first question is, how'd you get away with getting to have so much critical theory in your book? So I guess when you got interested in the way critical theory could be an avenue into understanding sports studies, like how, did you start with Foucault or did you start with Bourdieu, or was it, you know, you're like, actually, I love Butler, Judith Butler, and performativity got me in there. So I just kind of wonder how you did it. Did you come to sports first, or was it you were always a critical theory nerd, and as soon as you started taking these one theory, you realized, oh, I can use so many actually.
Oh yeah. No, I don't, I think again, in the same way that I feel like I was a sort of an accidental historian, I feel like I'm a reluctant Foucauldian. my advisor, you know, was really keen on, and I'm so thankful for it, right? Was really keen on, like, I think biopolitics and governmentality are really crucial for you. And, you know, as a grad student, you read it and you're like, oh my gosh, yes, this is everything that, you know, the way that he's talking about how biopolitics functions and how governmentality functions, and looking at my sites, I was just like, oh my gosh, it's all over the place. But you know, there's one, it's one thing to do what my master's advisor, Carrie Sandel, used to call Granimals. Granimals is this like Walmart brand that, you know, that helps kids like pick out the right top and the right bottom. So they would put like the animals in the tag so that the kid could go and be like, oh, I need to pick out two bears for a top and a bottom. And that, so that the Granimals approach is like, wow, this theory says a lot about my site. Ta-da! But I really struggled trying to get beyond that and to also talk about why I think it matters. And I think that what is valuable in Foucault is that Foucault is always talking about what was the now for him, right? You know, he's writing about the clinic, the birth of the clinic, and he's never saying, I'm going to give you a history of the clinic and why it's so terrible, right? What's powerful, I think, about Foucault for me is that he's always bringing it back to, do you see the way that this structure is now embedded in how we think of this, and that these systems and structures then, because they're so long, because it's taken so long for them to become embedded, because we don't even recognize them anymore, that's why it's so difficult to change them and to overturn them, which I think is useful. But I think too that, right, that to a certain extent, Foucault is like, whatever, we can't get out of it, right? Like we're stuck in this mire, and you know, I think there are ways that we can get out, but at the end of the day, you know, he's pretty skeptical that we can make those changes, which is where I think it's interesting, because right, Judith Butler and the idea of performativity is sort of where I started, but she isn't huge in my books. I rely so much more on Foucault. What's interesting is that the work that I'm doing now, I'm returning to Butler, in part because Butler is also starting to like really talk more in terms of biopolitics. So I've been turning a lot more to her and Achille Mbembe, which I think is sort of where, especially now, right, with sort of the place that the world is, which is not where it was. This is a dumb thing to say, but it's not where it was when I wrote this book. But biopolitics just now are even more important. And if I had known that when I was writing this or when I was writing my dissertation, that eugenics would somehow make its way back into the zeitgeist of the way in which we talk about the world on a regular basis, I would have been like, no way, but here we are.
Yeah. Well, it certainly, I've taught kind of, you know, governmentality and biopolitics for a fair while now. And now if you ask students to point out examples of biopolitics, it's like, really? Like our whole life, everything. So it is kind of, it does reshape the way in which at least my teaching practices happen. So I want to turn now to kind of the content of the book. And I just will point out for people who haven't read it, there are these framing chapters kind of at the beginning and the end, intros, conclusions, but the body of it are five chapters that happen in the Progressive Era, and most of them are I would say, centered around a single figure, that provide a kind of hinge for understanding other things that are going on. But they all have a kind of underpinning, which is that there's a kind of overarching thing that maybe you, I think you're trying to say that physical culturists are doing in the progressive era. And so I'm wondering if you can tell us kind of just broadly and overall, what does for your, at least for your book, what is the physical, what do physical culturists do in the progressive era? Like, what is their underlying and major goal? How does this connect to questions of whiteness and of gender that you tease out so well in all of your chapters?
Oof, that's a lot.
I know, it's a big question. Okay. It's kind of the big, you know, what's the, I guess I'm asking what the thesis of your book is. No, but in an awkward way.
Yes. So I think that ultimately from the perspective of these physical culturists, they were by and large interested in reform. They were really, I wish if I could go back and retitle my book, it would be in the reform era, because they're really interested in reform, and they're really interested in the sort of the central crux of, you know, post-industrial revolution, everybody's living in the cities, everybody is working their bodies in ways that is no longer healthy, right? Like human bodies are changing because of the kinds of work that people are trying to do in the cities. And so I think that overall, you know, regardless of gender, that these physical culturists were invested in, you know, what does it look like to sort of come into a city and do this kind of reform work with specific populations. Now, I think that overall, that's what they were all invested in. I think that the four figures that I talk about, well, the Del Sarte chapter is a little funky, but do that in various ways, and also, you know, are invested in that project in different ways. For example, like I would say that, you know, was Bernard McFadden really interested in reform, or was he interested in sort of highlighting and forwarding his own brand? I think he was interested in highlighting and sort of selling books and like making money, but also, I mean, he wrote thousands of pages of material about physical culture. And so if that was just about his own brand, you know, I think, you know, he wasn't, he's kind of framed as like the P.T. Barnum of physical culture. And I think that there's more to him than that. But, you know, I think that like Dudley Allen Sargent who was at Harvard. He was the physical director at Harvard at the beginning of the 20th century, was supremely interested, was particularly interested in women. And that's sort of the central focus, right, is that there was this big issue in the progressive era about women all suddenly wanting to go to college. And there was still a lot of medical quackery out there that suggested that, you know, when women went into college and started thinking, that all of the energy that was supposed to be in their reproductive organs got sucked up to their heads. And then, oh my gosh, then they're not going to, you know, make babies. And so I think that this was a fix. I think that physical culture in colleges in particular, in women's colleges, was seen as a fix to what was viewed as a real problem, the problem of women going to college. So I think that, you know, and if it wasn't in college, the other side of this, right, is that the influx of young women into cities in order to get to do work. And so like the YWCA was very much invested in trying to create communities of women in the cities that they were in to sort of help protect women And the YWCA was very open about, you know, and prevent them from you know, going to, you know, becoming sex workers or sort of relying on, you know, what at the time was viewed as less than savory. Well, even now, less than savory sort of means of getting by. And so in that case, right, physical culture was that kind of intervention to create community, but to also help women who were coming from rural areas into cities try and navigate that space and themselves in a way that was empowering and also Christianizing as well, right? It was also still about, and you will do this all through Christ, which is a long shot from where the YWCA is now. So I think that, you know, primarily that's what they were interested in. What my book argues, right, is that a huge part of that was in this is early, right? Eugenics is really something that hits its stride in the 20s. But that the seeds of the impulses of eugenics are really in all of these reform efforts that are incredibly concerned with young women's ability to reproduce, that so many of the exercises, so much of the rhetoric was sort of tacitly and implicitly and sometimes explicitly still about making sure that these young women could give birth successfully. That they could still be, and not only give birth successfully, that their bodies would be able to handle it, but that also, you know, inculcating sort of the values of motherhood on these women, right? It was never a sort of, hey, come and learn how to do physical culture and you can actually, you know, find yourself a job. Although, you know, in women's physical culture, many of them did go off to become physical directors themselves because it was so gender segregated at the time. But so much of it was about, you know, and I talk about this in the book, that when you really drill down, it often was tied explicitly or implicitly to bettering the white race, especially for women's physical culture.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that came through really clearly because I think you reiterated in a good way again and again that, you know, whether it's Dudley Allen Sargent's kind of looking at the improvement of, you know, women who could maybe afford to go and can go to upper class, you know, universities in the Northeast versus, you know, Mayhew and the YM or the YWCA in Minneapolis. Like we're seeing this thing at different angles. And of course, one of your most fascinating chapters, the last kind of body chapter, looking at physical culture for Indigenous women and girls in the U.S. I think is really rich. Let's turn, though. You say it's weird, but I think it was like weird, like a great wine weird. It was funky in a cool way. Your chapter on Delsart, I was digging on it. So maybe you can tell. I don't think a lot of people don't know about Americanized Delsart. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about what it is and how it came to become popular in America, and what is this Steele McKay guy doing anyway? So
yeah. Man, and I'll tell you, you know, as a side note before I say anything about Delsart, you know, in my part of the impetus behind focusing the book on whiteness actually came from one of my committee members when I defended my dissertation, who, you know, read it and was like, this is great, and I'm all on board with you. But I just feel like when you say women, that actually you mean white women. And that matters to your site in a way that you haven't really investigated it. And it and it was one of those things. It was like, yeah, you're right. But I couldn't let it go. And that is actually how I sort of turned to the added chapters are the Del Sarte chapter from my dissertation, the Del Sarte chapter, and the chapter on physical culture or lack thereof in indigenous reform schools. And so getting to Del Sarte was about, in the sites that I had, watching these or seeing pictures and videos of these women in white leotards, where I was like, look, it's so clear that these are white women and you're trying to make them even whiter, which is where I sort of like went into Del Sarte. And it's in part because the physical culture sites that I began with, which is, like I said, Abby Mayhew at the Minneapolis YWCA, and then Dudley Allen Sargent at Harvard, and then Bernard McFadden all over, Del Sarte, Americanized Del Sarte, was a fundamental aspect of all of their approaches to women's physical culture. And while Del Sarte has been talked about in scholarly circles, at least in regards to its connection to dance, it's really poo-pooed by sports historians as the non-sport. I mean, I open up one of the chapters sort of talking about going to my first sports history conference and having this really big name scholar, as I'm showing this video of a woman going through Del Sarte poses, you know, tell me at the end, you're talking about this like it's exercise, and that was not exercise. And that is part of why Americanized Del Sarte, I don't think it's really talked about in sports history, because it is sort of seen as, you know, some weird fad of the late 19th century that thankfully we've moved beyond. And the funny thing is that in theater, where Del Sarte was also super huge in terms of it was a regular and popular sort of actor training, school of actor training, it is also poo-pooed by theater people who are just like, you know, all it did was create stilted performances that were, you know, anything but sort of realistic. And I tend to, you know, get really interested by those places where everybody disavows something. Sports is disavowing it. Theater is disavowing it. And the only people who sort of avowed it are dance scholars. And then they do so cautiously, right? So Del Sarte. So right, Del Sarte was this French dude who actually was not interested in physical culture or exercise at all. He was really interested in how you could develop vocal techniques, mainly vocal techniques, but also facial expressions, and then gesture. How you could develop a series of movements that would align with the spiritual realm and cosmos in a way that was sort of symmetrical and natural. So for example, you know, he would sort of make these drawings of, you know, a face that was making a particular expression, and then would overlay, you know, shapes from nature in order to prove that that particular expression was aligned with the cosmos. Okay, so in comes Steele Mackay, who, you know, works with Del Sarte in his final years, and they apparently all of the sort of retellings of them meeting, it was, you know, people use like firework metaphors and all of this stuff, and so Steele Mackay, you know, took all of these ideas back to the States, and Steele Mackay was an actor. So he was most interested in the sort of gestural aspects of Del Sarte. And so he started to teach it, you know, very much in the way that we have all of these different kind of certificates that you can get in like acting, in different sort of schools of acting. So he started to teach it as a kind of school of acting and movement and gesture. And then all of his students kind of took it in their own directions, and it fractured. And, you know, this was long before you could like trademark, or they were interested in trademarking, you know, their teaching techniques. So it just made its way into so many things like silent film. You can see sort of resonances of Delsarte and Delsarte movement in silent films, modern dance. One of the ways that when people are like, what's Delsarte? I'm like, do you know The Music Man? Oh, yeah. And I'm like, yeah, the whole scene where they talk about one Grecian urn and they do it in togas, that is the sort of pop culture popular version of what Delsarte is, right? Women in togas, sort of doing these stilted yoga looking poses while reciting poems is like the down and dirty version of what Delsarte was.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I read that the beginning. Well, I read the beginning of that chapter and I thought, oh, good academic gossip. But then I also thought, you know, from a perspective of a French historian and looking at the early part of the 20th century, you know, Delsarte and dance fit very intimately into, you know, conversations about how women were supposed to participate in physical culture. Like, you would never have fragmented out dance from French female physical culture. And into the 40s, you can, like, my own research is on Vichy, and into the 40s, you find Delsarte in official government publications on sport, you know, in magazines called like Stadium and things like that. So it's funny that it has its own history in the historiography of sport, but you can see why. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think too, like, especially in like US colleges, Delsarte was the way in which dance made its way into higher education. And I think I talk about that a little bit in the book that you know, the birth of women's colleges and the sort of putting in physical culture as something they had to do every day happened simultaneously. And dance and theater came later. So Delsarte, without that bridge, without the Delsarte sort of bridge, because Delsarte was being used in those physical culture classes, you know, I think, do you get to dance? I don't know. I think it was really, and there are other scholars, right, that talk in depth and extensively about that.
Your next chapter does kind of, I mean, in some ways, the Delsarte does work for you also a bit as a bridge, but your next chapter on Dudley Allen Sargent talks explicitly about kind of physical culture for women in university. So maybe you could tell us a bit about Dudley Allen Sargent and what was, you know, what was the interconnection between nature, science, and kind of mimetic exercise?
Sure. Yeah. So he's an interesting, all of these folks, right? I kind of adore them cautiously. So he was a really interesting dude, right? He is not who you would think would be at Harvard. And I think it's incredibly important to look at that, you know, he started by doing circus tricks in I think his uncle's basement in Maine. And then somebody was like, hey, you're really good at those tumbling. Why don't you come and teach some physical education classes? And so he sort of built this reputation with no like formal training whatsoever. And made his way to Harvard. And he never felt like he belonged there. And the departments and the higher ups in the administration worked really hard to sort of also, you know, make him feel like maybe he didn't belong there. But because he came from this background, he was really regularly sort of invested in trying to, again, prescribe sort of exercises that would help, not just Harvard men, but what he was really known for was actually, this summer school that he taught at Harvard that enrolled primarily women who wanted to be physical education, physical culture teachers. And he used to go and actually teach physical culture classes like in Boston for like factory girls. And it, again, excuse me, he was primarily interested in trying to come up with ways in which these working women and teachers could come up with sort of prescriptions of exercises in order to make people become the sort of best physical versions of themselves. But the wacky thing about Dudley Allen Sargent, the thing that, you know, when people are like, who is this guy and why do you write about him? I'm like, well, so he had tens of thousands of measurements that he took and had other people take of college students, of sort of police academies, firefighters, tens of thousands of these cards that are at Harvard that take detailed measurements of people's bodies. And not like the measurements that, like, you know, if you were going to sort of measure how your body changes over a workout, you would take, you know, your shoulders and your hips and your waist. No, this guy like took like, you know, how far from, you know, the tip of your thumb to your wrist, you know, how far from your shoulder blade to your elbow. And he accumulated all of this data. And said that he could, based on what your measurements were, prescribe a sort of set of exercises that would get you to this kind of ideal mean, not the average, but the mean, and change the way that your body was shaped. The wild thing about it is that he took all these measurements, he accumulated them, and then made them into, like, I guess, averaged them and came up with, like, well, I guess the mean. He came up with the mean, and then he gave that mean from the sort of men and the women, tens of thousands of measurements, to a sculptor and said, here, I want you to create a, you know, a sculpture based on these measurements. And then it was displayed at the 1893 Columbian Expo in Chicago. And it created all of this debate, this picture. They were created to look like Greek statuary. So there's all kinds of sort of overlapping ways in which they're, trying to say, look, you know, it, building an idea of what is the American woman. And here are the measurements of tens of thousands of college women that we're going to make into this statue. And he thought that it would be a really great, like, look, let's celebrate the American college woman. And it actually created all of this debate because critics tended to think that she wasn't in very good shape. And so, like, why wasn't she in good shape? And, like, why, you know, and people who were, you know, trying to argue against the corset at that point were, like, trying to mobilize the statue as a, like, this is why women can't wear the corset. But then people on the other side were like, no, this is what college does to women's bodies and we can't let them go to college. It was just, I don't think he really expected it to take off like that. But that's one of those things that he was sort of famous for.
The other thing I really liked, by the way, your book has a lot of like funny things in it. when I'm thinking about Sargent, I'm only going to think about him sitting on a chair on a high wire.
Right.
The other thing I really liked, the other thing I really liked about this chapter is you introduced this notion of a surrogation and how he's attempted to kind of like reintroduce rural values through kind of these exercises that you can just do over and over again. So you don't have to be working class to get the kind of the musculature of a working class person. I found that to be a really interesting idea.
Yeah, and so many of our exercises still do that thing, right? So like there was one point where that chapter, I was going to write a whole chapter on the historiography of the squat. And I was going
to... You must do this. You have to do this.
Yeah. That I was going to be like, you know, if I could trace back the squat to the gesture of wood chopping, which is really what I think, if you, and that's the one of the examples that I use, that, you know, how many of our exercises that we do now that we don't even think about, like the, you know, the squat, or, you know, I just finished directing a show where they had to stretch all the time, like the butterfly stretch, right? All these stretches that we have these names for, like how many of them actually could be traced back to what I think the squat was originally, which is, you know, was pulling from the actual action of chopping wood and then trying to borrow that for the city without actually doing the chopping of wood, in order to make bodies that had the same fitness as their rural counterparts, while also at the same time like invalidating and talking about those rural counterparts as if they didn't exist anymore, as if they were some kind of relic of the past that didn't exist in this new metropolis, you know, metropolitan way of living. And I think physical culture does this a lot. And this is how whiteness and gender, and all of those things make their way into sports, is that they get sort of relabeled as something else. So you don't think, you know, when you're at the gym doing a squat, you don't think that this is an appropriation of, you know, what was once sort of seen as low class rural labor. But it might be.
Yeah, totally. And by the way, you absolutely have to do that now. And I want to read an article on the historiography and the exerciseography of the squat, I guess. That sounds great.
Sweet, I'll get right on.
You do really well. Yeah, let's get right on that. One of the things I really love about your book, actually, is how it explains that tension really well, that tension between kind of the celebration of the quote-unquote natural, but also the fear of the natural, and you see that a lot in your chapter on Abhishek Mayhew, where on one hand, you know, there's this sense that obviously, quote unquote, women are connected to the carnivalesque and the grotesque, and we need to be wary of kind of untrammeled female naturalness, which is just chaos. And yet on the other hand, like what we need is naturalistic exercise so we can get the benefits of that naturalness without the unrestrainedness of it, right? So actually what we need is kind of like, oh, you use a better term. I'm not able to describe it as well as you do in the book, but you like self-control and self-management become central to the notion of both kind of what you call social motherhood, but also whiteness itself. Like whiteness itself becomes about self-management. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about kind of Abhishek Mayhew. What was she doing? Why you fell in love with her? What and explain to us your idea of social motherhood.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know that whole idea of like, cool, chopping wood is great, and adapting that for the city works really well when we're talking about masculine bodies, where that kind of rural labor is masculinized, but like that conjuring of nature becomes a little bit more problematic on feminized bodies, on women's bodies, because nature is a little bit more complicated, and the sort of assumption of women and nature at the time was a really complex problem that physical culture was supposed to solve on one hand, right? So the interesting thing about this period of time, and Shannon Jackson, who's I cite her a lot, right, talks about, you know, figures like Jane Addams and these, you know, first wave feminists who were out there and saying, like, yes, like, women, you need to take charge, you need to be the managers, you need to have your job, you need to do all these things. But we're still mobilizing the rhetoric of domesticity in order to sort of validate that, right? Like, you can do all these things, but so they were saying, you know, women should go out and be, you know, in the city and sort of work for reform, because women are best suited to do that reform because they know how to run a household. So it was a lot of the ways in which physical culture mobilized the rhetoric of domesticity, sort of mobilized nature, not in terms of like, yes, women should go out and run through the woods, and but in terms of like, you know, their women's nature is to be maternal. And that is how they justified to a lot of these exercises that they were asking women to do. So Abby Shaw Mayhew is wonderful and wild, because she, you know, at a time when Del Sarte was super popular, and she was really good at Del Sarte, and she taught Del Sarte, but she also, like, she started women's sports at the University of Wisconsin. She was all about basketball, and believed that women should be allowed to compete, which is something that even Dudley Allen Sargent was like, no, women should not be involved in sports. They can be physically active, but they shouldn't be involved in sports. And Abby Shaw Mayhew was like, no, they should be doing all of the things. And so when she was in Minneapolis, she did, you know, gym work, right, sort of like women's exercise classes that all of these other folks did. But she came from Wellesley, and Wellesley already had these sort of outing groups. So she would have women have a rowing club and a bicycling club, and they would do basketball tournaments, but friendly basketball tournaments, which I guess took the competition part out of it, like all over the city. And so there are these articles from the time that sort of describe these women in really sort of grotesque and outrageous ways that, you know, in her reports, Abby Shaw Mayhew is like super proud of, but also, right, was being pressured to sort of justify the ways in which this outrageous sort of bodily autonomy that was all over the streets of and lakes of Minneapolis wasn't just, you know, kind of girls gone wild at the end of the 19th century. And the way that she justified that was through a really hefty rhetoric of domesticity, a really hefty rhetoric that this is how women learn to be closer to God and to Christ, and that this was how they could sort of envision their Christ-likeness. And the way that was then tied explicitly to their whiteness was also sort of a part of that justification. So she's a confounding figure, because on one hand, you know, she absolutely falls into the sort of same bucket as like Jane Addams and that first wave of feminist reformers who are really pushing the boundaries of what was, you know, acceptable femininity, you know. And then on the other hand, she's saying things like, you know, at the end of the day, this is about furthering the race. This is about, you know, making women better, you know, housekeep, you know, better managers of their homes. And what's interesting about her, and I've also haven't quite found enough evidence to like say this, but she never married. And there's at least in one of the two censuses, she was living with a female companion in her later life. So I think that there's also, again, I need to do all of the research, but I have some suspicions that she might have also been queer, which then just really makes all of this stuff even more complicated and confounding. As somebody who is kind of loves her.
Yeah, I obviously I caught the reference at the end of the chapter to her living with a companion, and I have to admit, in reading the McFadden chapter next, I also caught like a hint of queerness, because I'm thinking about the kind of the link between homosociality in Germany and these physical cultural magazines, how they were like an early way for German queer communities to express queerness in public. And I was like, oh, is that what's going, is like, but then you read about Bernard McFadden's like third wife and her seventh childbirth, and he's making her jump off a 46-foot cliff. You're like, what is going on here? So I have to admit, I was wondering that a little bit in the next chapter as well. These two chapters together for me really were rich because of the way in which they both kind of deal with this question of female physical perfectibility and kind of the notion of the kind of ideal female body type. And so I wondered if you could talk a little bit about, maybe a little bit about McFadden and who is Bernard McFadden, and why, and suddenly in this chapter, we get a lot about pregnancy and childbirth. So I wonder if you could talk about McFadden and childbirth and pregnancy.
Yeah, so he made it just super explicit, right? Like, there were ways in which Sargent and Abby Mayhew, you know, linked sort of to women, you know, in childbirth and women as mothers, but like it wasn't central. And for Bernard McFadden, that was central. Like, the ideal woman for him was a mother. He's been described in so many different ways. He's been described as like the P.T. Barnum of physical culture. He's also been described by folks that I know as sort of a proto-Trump. He ran for president later in his life. You know, he was, a sort of media tycoon, like one of the first media tycoons before the media was the media. And, you know, he was the supreme showman, he was doing Evel Knievel kind of stunts, like before that was the cool thing. You can point to so many other physical culture folks like Jack LaLanne as sort of down the kind of evolutionary tree of physical culturists that starts with Bernard McFadden. And he wrote, because he was, right, a media tycoon, you know, he wrote all of these magazines. He wrote the Encyclopedia of Physical Culture. But none of it was like, right, he had a beginnings very similar to Dudley Allen Sargent. He, you know, grew up in the Ozarks. Like, I don't know why I always think when I listen to that first song from Hamilton about where Alexander Hamilton comes from, I'm always like, oh, that's like Bernard McFadden too. That, you know, he lost his parents. He was sort of on his own. He didn't have an education. While Dudley Allen Sargent was showing his statues at the Columbian Expo, Bernard McFadden was like demonstrating a rower. He also had those working class roots. And he also did like amazing things. Like there's evidence that, you know, Bernard McFadden was the first person to bring yoga to the United States. He was an ardent vegetarian. He said like amazing things like, you know, you shouldn't just eat meat and bread and butter. You should have whole grains and you should eat vegetables. And people at the time were like, what? You're a quack. So he did all these really amazing things. But then, you know, he was borderline and sometimes not borderline abusive towards his wives. He was certainly sort of emotionally distant and potentially neglectful of his children. And all because, you know, he just believed that his beliefs about physical culture were true. And so his first, well, I think actually she was his second wife, Mary, was like, you know, was a champion swimmer in the UK. And when he married her, she was like 19 and he was like, way too old. I can't think of exactly how old he was at the time, but, and then, you know, his whole plan, right, was that they were going to be the world's physical culture couple. And so she has a sort of salacious autobiography called Dumbbells and Carrot Strips that is just fascinating. And she talks about the fact that she understood that her job was to come on board and sort of make babies. And she did really quickly. And one of the main things that he did when they were on tour together, right after they got married, is that he used to sort of have her jump off of a table onto his abs. He made her, and I tried so hard to find evidence or some kind of record of this dive off of the pier while she was 8 months pregnant, but I could not find it. But she talks about, you know, being 8 months pregnant and he forced her as a sort of, you know, demonstration of her virile, you know, sort of hardcore, amazing pregnancy to jump off of this pier into the waters at Brighton Beach. And she talks about how she was terrified, right? She was terrified that this was going to do harm to the baby, do harm to her. But she did it. She did it anyway. And then once she had all of these children, which much, I think, to Bernard's open dismay at times, she had all girls. then he toured them around. So then they became this sort of physical culture family. You know, yes, he was interested in exercises, but he was as interested in exercises combined with diet, combined with sleeping with an open window when it's 20 degrees outside and snow baths and all of these sort of bizarre ways of living that for him, physical culture wasn't just a sort of series of exercises that you go and work out. You know, for him, physical culture was an entire way of being in the world. And for him, that being in the world was firmly focused on, if you're a man, your job is to go out and reproduce. And if you're a woman, your job is to make babies. And so much of his sort of, he has an entire 1,000-page book about, like, these are all the steps you need to do in order to be a good mom and how to get pregnant and how to give birth and how to take care of your baby. He was writing, you know, what to expect when you're expecting long before those kinds of self-help manuals were out there.
Yeah, so your book for me, Shannon, does such a great job of kind of tracing out that line from the late 19th century through to kind of the eugenics movement of the 1920s, and really pays special attention to the role that physical culture plays in trying to shape women's bodies in particular. But then you pose a question in your conclusion, I think, that really sharpens the whole book, which is you say, like, can this white supremacist roots of physical culture be challenged? And in some ways, you're trying to look at that in chapter six as well, Exercise for Assimilation, where you're looking at Indigenous women. So I wonder if because that seemed to be where you land, like, okay, the so what of this, why this is important, why people who maybe aren't interested in the reform or the progressive era, why they should read it. Is this, and it's a huge question. I mean, I was shocked when I started reading your book and I was like, wait, this is starting with a white supremacist gym in today. So I wonder if did you end up answering that question for yourself? And what should we all be doing, I guess?
Yeah, I think that's really the crux of what my next project is. And I think that it's about, especially now, right? Again, I think that the sort of world that I wrote most of this book in and the world we're in now seem very different. But that question came from a place of, you know, in theater, we have a huge sort of subfield that is theater for social change. And how can you use performance and theater techniques in order to sort of go out and affect cultural and social change in the world? And part of that question was like, so what is the equivalent in sports? And I still am not sure that there is something, but I point to a couple of examples in that last chapter. And I do think too that a lot of that has shifted sort of in the pandemic. Talk that I gave like a year ago was about how sports and athletes were sort of given an ability, or at least took on being more political during the pandemic, like, you know, the sort of protests, the, you know, wearing, you know, certain things on their uniforms or like t-shirts to warm up, the explicit linking of the NBA with the Black Lives Matter movement. I think that there are ways in which sports and physical culture has shifted. And also, like, one of the, I talk about a couple of different physical fitness gurus now who are mobilizing a lot of that physical fitness work in order to kind of talk about how it can help you become a sort of a revolutionary or a radical. And it's not like this is the first time, right? There's so many examples of the ways, especially in like Germany and Czechoslovakia and like the Sokol movement, of how physical culture has been mobilized before in order to kind of further a political cause. But I do still wonder, you know, what exactly does sports or physical fitness for social change look like? And so a lot of what I'm looking at now is about trying to think about what that might look like, and how it has to change necessarily to, and this is where Judith Butler comes back in the sort of world that we're in right now, where it just seems like, you know, it's climate change and it's genocide and it's, this sort of constant barrage of, you know, what do we pay attention to? And when we say social justice, what are we talking about? 'Cause we're kind of talking about all of it. But how can sports and theater sort of talk to each other and borrow from each other in this, you know, pandemic moment, and in this sort of, yet again, you know, where white nationalism is on the rise in so many places? What is it that theater and sports do really well that can help further that cause of social justice?
Well, I certainly was really interested in your discussion of the shift towards community and a kind of more critical approach to physical culture as performance, as a way to challenge that Foucauldian notion of governmentality. Like, actually, if we get down on the grassroots and we really think about what we're doing and the reasons we're doing it in a critical way, then we can challenge the kind of racial and gendered underpinnings of our sports systems. I thought that's true. That strikes me as very true, and not at all the kind of, there's a lot of, I think, rah-rahing a sport as a way of bringing people together, but actually it only really works to undermine the base, the racial and gendered bases of society if we do it on purpose, right?
Yeah.
So I did.
And like theater theorizes about this a lot, right? That yay, we love entertainment. We love, you know, our Broadway shows, but like that there is an underside to bringing people in to see a show and only entertaining them or only sort of getting them to forget about their troubles. And so, right, a lot of avant-garde work, a lot of theater for social change work is about trying to undo that sort of like, come in here and forget all your troubles and just have fun. And so I wonder, you know, what would that look like if it, you know, for an audience for a sporting event, you know, how could you make you know, a sporting audience sort of use that communal space where everybody feels linked regardless of you know, ideology in order to actually get them to think together to make the world better.
Well, it sounds like this is some of the bases for your next project. Is that it, Shannon?
Yeah. I'm
small,
starting.
Small goals.
super small. I was like, oh no. Yeah, trying to think about like how community and collectivity, which I think are sports and theater's superpowers. That those two things, that's what they do best, you know, bring people together and feel that sense of like togetherness amongst strangers. You know, how can that be mobilized in a way that is fruitful for everybody involved in that process? So I'm looking at, and I've been doing, I just finished, directing a play called The Wolves, which is a, on campus, which is a play about a women's soccer team, women's football team. And it was kind of amazing because it was also the very first play that we did in person after doing, you know, only digital stuff. So the way that, you know, community and sort of what happens, you know, when you put a collective together was just like, I don't know, cranked up like five levels in this show because we were just so happy to be together on a daily basis and trying to make theater again. But I also think that there's, you know, there's just so much in the pandemic on the sports and sort of physical fitness end because our superpowers are getting people together. That we lost our superpowers, you know, over the pandemic, right? So what does an NBA game look like without fans? Well, now we know, you know, and what do we do with that? I mean, can you really call sports if there aren't live fans there? Can you call theater if there aren't fans there? Like we've all, you know, sort of gone back to that place of like the roots of our definition of who we think we are as sports and theater makers. And in that place, you know, I think there's a huge opportunity to rethink being more equitable about our definitions as we move forward.
Well, I hope so. Thank you so much for joining me today, Shannon.
Thank you, Keith. This was fun.
We've been talking today to Shannon Walsh. She's an associate professor of theater history at Louisiana State University, and she's the author of a book I really think you all should read, Eugenics and Physical Culture Performance in the Progressive Era, Watch Whiteness Work Out. Although maybe for its second edition, it'll be in the Reform Era.
Maybe.
Thank you again, Shannon. You've been listening to New Books in Sports, a channel on the New Books Network. I am Keith Rathbone coming to you from Macquarie University. Thank you very much for listening.